I'm Sarah Mendelson. I'm a senior fellow here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and welcome. This is the second in what we hope will be a regular event where we're discussing human trafficking and peacekeeping operations. Last month we had Helga Conrad, who is the OSCE focal point on human trafficking. I'm thinking that in 2006 perhaps we will have representatives from the Department of Defense, from the other large NATO troop contributing countries for peacekeeping, that is the British, the French, the Germans, and the Italians. Perhaps they'll also come talk to us about what their efforts are on combating human trafficking and links with peacekeeping operations. We'd love to hear from the NATO military office as well at NATO. I think we'll probably invite UNDPKO, and in fact, UNDPKO called us and asked to be on the panel. And we thought it was unfair because we hadn't, first of all, we have a full roster of folks here, but we thought that we would give a separate time for UNDPKO to speak. I think we'll probably also be inviting Prince Said, perhaps on the year anniversary of his very important, might I say, revolutionary report that he delivered last March. And we would welcome hearing from defense contractors and the contracting community. On several occasions, we've tried to reach out, and we'd very much like to hear from companies on what the companies are doing on this issue. I should say, this is not just a government or companies or non-governmental issue. There is certainly a role for the press to play. I recommend to you a very interesting series that was in the Chicago Tribune by a reporter named Cam Simpson, who I've not yet met. The Tribune, in an unusual move, sent me the article, and it's about how contractors, and in this case KB&R, Kellogg Brown and Root, had subcontracted to a series of companies and were essentially involved in labor trafficking into Iraq to support troop efforts in Iraq. So it's something, if you're interested in this, I recommend to you. For those of you who are in the press, I ask that if you want to quote any of us, that you specifically ask and ask about the quotes, okay? So the order that we're gonna go in is we're gonna hear from Sarah Martin, who is the gender advocate for Refugees International and has a brand new report out and really sort of drove this event today because we thought it was such a great opportunity to hear from her on new and fresh information on how the peacekeeping community is relating to both human trafficking and sexual exploitation abuse. Then I'm going to speak briefly on efforts that our efforts at CSIS to advance this issue and some research that we've done. Then we're going to hear from Martina Vandenberg, who is formerly of Human Rights Watch and the author of Hopes Betrayed, which was a groundbreaking study that Human Rights Watch produced in 2002 on trafficking into Bosnia and links with peacekeeping operations. And she is now an attorney at Jenner and Block LLP. And then Maureen Walsh, who has been a close comrade in arms. She is the general counsel at the Helsinki Commission and works with Mr. Chris Smith, a representative from New Jersey and the author, along with Maureen and other staff, of the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. And she will tell us both about OSCE efforts at dealing with this as well as where we are in the current legislation. So without further ado, we're going to hear from Sarah Martin. Thank you.
Hi, welcome. My name is Sarah Martin. I'm with Refugees International. For those of you who don't know Refugees International, we're a small independent advocacy organization based here in Washington, D.C. We don't accept any funding from the U.S. government or from the United Nations or any government, and so we are able to maintain our independence and say what we see fit to say. We conduct rapid assessments in areas of conflict, and I wrote this report, Must Boys Be Boys? Ending Sexual Exploitation and Abuse in UN Peacekeeping Missions, based on field work that I did in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Haiti, and the DR Congo. I traveled to Liberia 3 times in the past year. I was there November 2003, March 2004, and December 2004. And then I went to Haiti with my colleague Peter Gantz, who's here in the audience, in February 2005, where we also looked at the issue of sexual exploitation and abuse in peacekeeping missions. And then I was in the Congo this June in 2005. And while my research in the Congo was not focused primarily on sexual exploitation and abuse, since I was in Bunia, the epicenter of the Monuc scandal about sexual exploitation and abuse, I looked around a little and asked some questions. So I'm going to kind of provide kind of a little bit of an overview about sexual exploitation and abuse in UN peacekeeping missions, and then I'll talk a little bit about trafficking and what I've seen there. I decided to write the report on Liberia and Haiti because so much attention had been paid to the Congo a scandal where peacekeepers in Bunia and Ituri were found to be trading sex, food for sex. There was widespread rape and abuse. Young children were involved as well, and it was quite a scandal. And I felt that the attention seemed to be focusing on the Congo as if it were a lone case, kind of an outlier. But when I was in Liberia, and my first trip for Refugees International was to Liberia, it was evident from me from the day I landed there, 3 months after Charles Taylor left, before UNMIL was fully deployed, that this was a problem. When I was in Liberia, I asked questions about to local NGOs, to the UN staff, both UNDP, UNMIL staff, UNHCR, World Food Program, other groups like that. How do you report a problem about this? Because we constantly heard about peacekeepers taking pictures of children on the beach, harassing women and children outside of the internally displaced camps around Monrovia, at roadblocks, et cetera. You couldn't go into any of the restaurants or hotels in Monrovia without seeing scads of prostitutes interacting with international men, some in uniform, some not. And the answer was completely, bewildering to me. No two people could tell me how you could report a violation. I heard from the UNDP gender advisor, well, you would talk to the UN, to the UNMIL human rights advisor, who had been there 1 week. And I heard from the UNMIL human rights advisor, no, you talk to the UNDP gender advisor. I talked to the international NGOs. They say, well, I guess we could try to tell them, but we don't know who handles this within UNMIL. The gender advisor, who had just landed and had been appointed in March, when I asked her back in March, said, no, that's not what I work on. I work on trying to get women in elections. I work on trying to get women in the DDR program. So this was an issue that while everyone was talking about it and aware of it, nobody was doing anything about it. I went, in November, and the story I like to tell is on my flight into Liberia, I was flying from Cote d'Ivoire on a little Guinean airline, UTA Airlines, and there were 6 of us on the plane, and my colleague Michelle Brown and I were checking in, and there were 2 Ukrainian women and two men of whose nationality I couldn't determine. The reason I know they were Ukrainian women is because when we were filling out our immigration forms, I went and stood near them so I could see where their passports were from. And I was just shocked because I was naive about the issue of trafficking. And they were young. They were probably 18 or 19 years old. And I was just kind of surprised. I was like, gosh, are they going to visit their boyfriends who live in Liberia? Why would they be going to Liberia? It's 3 months since Charles Taylor left. I'm a little nervous and scared to go to Liberia. Why are they going? Well, when I found out when I got to Liberia that, in fact, there had been discos and brothels that were springing up throughout Monrovia. And this is, as I'd like to repeat, about 3 months into the deployment of peacekeeping troops there. And these women were going to work there. And I was told that Moroccan and Ukrainian women were working in these different discos and brothels there. Haiti has a similar problem. Haiti has been well renowned because their state has been in disarray for years and years and years. There's drug trafficking, there's human trafficking, there's prostitution is rampant and rife. There's very little rule of law programs in place. Prostitution is illegal in Haiti, yet it's not prosecuted. You can walk down the streets of Pétionville, the wealthy suburb where the UN offices are and where, all of the expats in general live. And there's prostitutes in front of every hotel on every corner at night. So it's something that's against the law in Haiti but is tolerated. While I was there, I was very interested and concerned to see how the UN might be handling sexual exploitation and abuse there. And what I found is, since the Monuc scandal had erupted, that the UN was, in fact, taking it quite seriously. They had the typical one or two people whose job it was to handle it in the mission, the same as what I saw in Liberia. But because of the attitude of the special representative of the Secretary General there, they had immediately issued zero tolerance policies, zero contact policies, which was something new, saying you could not have sex with anyone in Haiti. And it was very, it was heartening to see that, yet there were still problems. While I was there, two Pakistani police officers were accused of raping a young Haitian woman. And my colleague and I went to the press conference that the MINUSTAH held. And the press officer hastened to tell us, no, it wasn't rape, it was just prostitution. Well, and this was shocking because there's a zero tolerance, zero contact rule that everyone knew about. Prostitution is illegal in Haiti, yet this was still the attitude within the mission that, no, let's not, you know, ruin people's careers over prostitution. It's just prostitution. And that was something that I wanted to focus on in this report, because it seems to me that in the UN peacekeeping missions, there's evolved a hyper-masculine culture that tolerates and keeps a wall of silence around the issue of sexual exploitation and abuse. I've been having some very interesting meetings up in New York with the UN missions since I released this report, meeting with the troop contributing countries. Because while I believe that DPKO is taking this seriously and trying within their abilities to address the issue, the troop contributing countries who contribute the militaries and the UN is made up of its member states. So. I've met with three of the four major troop contributing countries. India refused to meet with us, but they've talked to us and told us, yes, we believe this, we agree with it. But then they turn it around all the time and say, well, what are we to do? We're a poor country. We, you know, trying to invest money in this training and such, but this is the UN's problem. They need to give us the funding and the training to address this. But while I agree that with the military is a part of the problem, I think the other big problem that the UN is going to face is the fact that civilians are very much involved in the sexual exploitation and abuse as well. Many of the complaints I heard in Liberia, in Haiti, in the Congo, and any of the countries that we travel to that have civilian populations is, well, it's not just guys in uniform. I mean, in Haiti, they don't allow the troops to come with their civilian clothes. And I was, we took a R&R couple of hours at the beach one day in Haiti, and the Chilean contingent was out there on R&R as well, in their uniforms that they hung up on the chaise lounges next to them, you know, and being watched like a hawk by their commanders. So there was no hanky-panky going on that day. But that's not the case with civilian personnel and UN peacekeeping missions as well. We saw in 2002 in West Africa that humanitarian agencies were involved in a scandal trading food for sex. It's much more difficult to say who works at the UN, who is a private contractor, who's a businessman in these peacekeeping missions. And there's no real standard code of conduct, et cetera, for everything. So while DPKO is trying to address this, then there's certainly a lot more work within the UN to do. I want to just talk briefly. I told DPKO I would tell you guys what the latest stats are and what they've been doing. Over the past 21 months, they've investigated 264 peacekeeping personnel, of which 16 civilians were dismissed, 16 policemen, and 116 military personnel were repatriated. And that's throughout their the peacekeeping missions. But now I want to talk a little bit more just about in Liberia and the trafficking problem that was going on there. I told you the story about coming in on the plane with the women that were being trafficked. I came back to New York. I went up to meet Anna Schotten at the Sexual Exploitation Abuse Focal Point at DPKO, and I told her about this, and I said, yes, and everyone was complaining about the woman who was running the trafficking operation at DPKO. And she said, who is it? And I said, well, her name is Celia de la Varenne, and she's been working with Mr. Klein in Bosnia in the past, so she's supposed to be experienced, but everyone's complaining about it, and she was horrified. She took me to meet the trafficking officer at DPKO, and they said we had no idea that she was working in the field there. We had a lot of problems with her in Bosnia, and we spoke, you know, very strongly with Klein about this. This is shocking to us. This is exactly what we don't want the UN to be doing on trafficking. And the reason they didn't, and I think my colleagues can probably speak further about the Bosnia issue, but I'll tell you what was going on in Liberia, was she had a team of about seven very large military police officers that would go with her into the brothels and the bars, and she would rescue women. She would go in and grab the women who were working there and bring them back to save them. Now, there, she was the only woman working on the team. There was none of them spoke, you know, all the languages of the different women that were in there. The gender-based violence programs that were in place in Liberia at the time, this is about 5 months into it, were struggling just to work on the women of Liberia that they were there to help with the internally displaced and with the refugees that were there. I mean, rape was rampant in Liberia. The recent studies I saw said almost up to 60% of women in Liberia suffered some form of gender-based violence during the war. They were overwhelmed with the work that they had, and they were not consulted or brought into the work with the UN. And instead, the focal point, Ms. Laveran, would take the rescued women to IRC or ARC and say, okay, now take care of her, I've done my part. And what would happen is they had no facilities, no safe houses, no ways to interview or take care of these women. They were overwhelmed themselves. And oftentimes the women were terrified, did not want to be there, and would try to escape and find their own ways back home. I heard a story when I was there of the UNMIL putting a couple of women they had rescued on a plane to Cote d'Ivoire, where they were met on the other end by the men who had trafficked them and put them back on the next flight back into Liberia. And I brought this up with Celia, and she was like, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I don't have the resources I need, and am I supposed to just sit around and do nothing while this happens? And I was like, well, that's a great question. I'm not an expert on trafficking. But I said, well, certainly, you know, the people who've been working on trafficking are the same people who work on drug trafficking, arms trafficking, of which Liberia is rife with both of those. What are they doing about this? Are you collaborating with them? No, I don't have time. I have to go out and help these women. So this was very, very disturbing to hear, because while it looked like UNMIL was doing something about trafficking, and I wrote a bulletin about this, which is outside in the that you can pick up, they were actually putting the women further at risk. As I learned more about trafficking, I learned. DPKO took this matter up with Mr. Klein and fought hard to have her dismissed, but he won, and she stayed on and, in fact, became the sexual exploitation and abuse focal point for the entire mission for the next 4 or 5 months. So that was not an advocacy success we had, but we did raise the awareness there. This was, you know, particularly disturbing because I've read DPKO's policy itself about trafficking, and their policy is quite good. They talk about not do no harm. Everyone should realize that the peacekeepers are a source of demand. They are the demand that creates the trafficking around there. No peacekeeping mission should go out there without realizing that this is going to be an issue wherever they go. And there should be trafficking advisors deployed. Yet there was one woman at the time working in the headquarters and fighting an uphill battle to get the resources she needs to work on this. The coordination issue is huge. In the countries I've been, in Haiti and Liberia, the UN is basically the government. They run most of the services there. And so they need to ensure that they are respecting all the international laws, the laws of the country, et cetera. And this seems like a very large thing for one person in a mission of 15,000 people to do with no staff. And then the services for the victims is a huge issue that they're just incapable of providing, and unless they coordinate with the NGOs that are there, they're not going to be able to do that. So the other thing I wanted to point out before I turn it over to my colleagues is that in the UN peacekeeping guidelines for this, they point out that UN missions are not mandated to deal with trafficking. So this is a thing that they'd like to bring up. So within their mandate, they can do as much as they can. They can look at it as an SEA thing. But I think this is something that we need to keep bringing up with the UN so that they can address it better. Thank you.
It's a dangerous thing when you're policing yourself. So as the person who's running the clock, I will try and be vigilant. We do accept government funds. And in fact, the project that I ran here at CSIS in 2003 and 2004 was supported by the US State Department's Office to Combat and Monitor Trafficking. We, however, for a variety of reasons, publish the report and have to sell it rather than give it away, because frankly some of the findings were quite critical of the Department of Defense, and I think the State Department was a bit uncomfortable having their name behind it. So I offer for you barracks and brothels, and there are ways in which that you can purchase this. I'm going to briefly describe the relevant findings from this study that was published earlier this year, and I'm going to describe the activism that accompanied the study, and I'm going to comment today on where we are and what more needs to be done. I want to make very quickly an argument about how human trafficking is linked to peacekeeping operations. The majority of peacekeepers serve honorably. We have a lot of good research that Human Rights Watch has done, Amnesty International, International Organization of Migration, numerous other organizations that have detailed how trafficking in humans in peacekeeping operations follows the deployment. In Bosnia and Kosovo, they followed the deployment. They did not precede it. I invite all of us to investigate whether or not this is going on in Liberia. It'd be important to know whether that Ukrainian female had access to her passport, what kinds of conditions she was being kept in. We know that in the period 2000 to 2003, at least 5,203 females were trafficked to the Balkans following the deployment. We suspect the number is actually three times greater. We know that because the International Organization of Migration interviewed females who were willing to be repatriated. So it's a subset of people who've been trafficked, and it's a selected bias, right? It's people who are willing to go home. But it's an important source of information. They tell us that they were sold multiple times. 10% of them are minors. 92% of them were from Albania, Moldova, Romania, and Bulgaria. They experienced tremendous amounts of violence, including rape. They were held as chattel, and they were in conditions of debt bondage, where they were constantly trying to, quote, work to work off a erroneous debt that they incurred. The central questions for the report that I wrote, Barracks and Brothels, was, okay, we know that trafficking follows peacekeeping deployments. Do the peacekeepers and the policymakers recognize this link? And the answer is not usually. How do peacekeepers and policymakers understand the situation? They have a very unclear understanding of the situation. I'll talk briefly about that. And how have organizations responded to peacekeeper involvement? The answer is minimally, although we do have new policies, both at the Department of Defense, NATO, and the UN, all signed on in 2004. And I'll return to that in a minute. The sources for my research were multiple interviews with military. I tapped into a military network that I was able to reach here at CSIS. We have a program of military fellows who come and serve for a year at CSIS. And I was able to interview many military that had served with the Russian military peacekeeping operations in Bosnia and Kosovo, and from there I was able to interview more and more. I was also privileged to travel with the Department of Defense Inspector General's office as they began to investigate complicity of uniformed service members and defense contractors in human trafficking, and we did that in the summer of 2003. That also allowed me to tap into some networks of contractors. And of course I'm aided by a transnational network. Some of the American side you see sitting at the table, but senior ambassadors at NATO, people working in the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, OSCE, UN representatives in Bosnia, shelter directors in Bosnia and Kosovo, the list is very long. And it's important always to remember in combating human trafficking, the network is imperative. Trafficking occurs through a network. You can only combat it through a network. The findings in the report are in many ways disturbingly similar to findings that Martina had in her report, that Sarah has in hers, including, and it's important to remember, that gender-based violence was prevalent, rampant in the places that the peacekeepers were going into, both in Bosnia and Kosovo. Rape is a war crime. The study ultimately details the widespread misperceptions concerning trafficking by those engaged in peacekeeping and policymaking. It is a story about organizational cultures that are permissive to these crimes and abuses. Now, defense and peacekeeping organizations generally, they tend to deny the links between trafficking and peacekeeping even when they have policies in place. They fail to grasp the security implications of human rights abuse by peacekeepers. This is not the only case of it. There are many other kinds of cases that we can discuss. But this inability to understand that the abuses that peacekeepers themselves engage in are themselves a security threat and undermine how the local population understands the peacekeepers, undermines the rule of law, prolongs peacekeeping missions. But it also taps into the fact that these organizations have failed to respond robustly to organized crime in a comprehensive manner. I think we are really behind the eight ball in addressing peacekeeping in a robust manner. We very much are sort of still in a kind of Cold War mentality, and this aspect of organized crime is really critical. It turns out, actually, that people who are interested in combating drugs and arms have not actually focused in Bosnia and Kosovo on combating human trafficking. And the people that I interviewed sort of thought this was all either about prostitution, which, by the way, is illegal in Bosnia and Kosovo, or that this was just something that they hadn't thought of. And there are reasons for that that I'll go into in a minute. But I think in the US case, what we also see in Bosnia and Kosovo, the cases that we've been able to detail really involve contractors. And there is a tendency to go like this. You heard it from Sarah Martin talking about the UN, and you see it very clearly in both Bosnia and Kosovo, where the US military is talking about defense contractors. And they sort of, there's a confusion about, well, what is our responsibility over defense contractors? And in fact, the GAO has done a study that says commanders of bases are, in fact, responsible for everybody on the base, and that includes defense contractors. But as we have privatized security arrangements, we haven't quite understood what are our obligations, including legal. Quickly, a word about misperceptions. And again, I obviously encourage you to read the report, page after page after page of not our boys, must be somebody else's military. It's a problem that is unseen, therefore it does not exist, which is a product of the fact that there are gaps in intelligence. You have military officers that are not required to track human trafficking. So therefore, it doesn't show up in reports. So therefore, it doesn't exist, even though you have hundreds of females who are in brothels, who we know from copious amounts of research have been held there against their will. A lot of confusion about, well, is she held against her will, or is she a willing participant? Isn't this legal? I interviewed a lot of uniformed service members who had served in places where, for example, in Germany, where prostitution was legal, and then they were in Bosnia and Kosovo, and they hadn't been briefed before they came in country, and they didn't quite understand the situation that they were facing, although we do have evidence that the military was talking about it. We have something called TTPs. The acronym is something like Techniques, Tactics, and Procedures for Prostitution Houses, and you read the sheet, and it says, if you go into coffee houses, you will encounter females who are some of them under 18. They're from places like Romania and Bulgaria. They're held without their passports. That is describing a trafficked female. But it never says these females have been trafficked, and this is what you should do, and here are local organizations that are dealing with this. And so it was extremely complicated. And we are all sort of coming to this, unfortunately, years late. Part of the message today is that there is no reason for this in places where we're currently deployed. Another final finding in the report that is most disturbing is there is an argument of soldiers' rights. This makes a peacekeeping mission better. One lieutenant colonel argued to me that his officers were, and his men were, happier if they had access to a beautiful 17-year-old, and that was making the mission a better one. That was quite shocking to me. But these are also not hypothetical cases. And again, in the report, I detail a couple cases where we find institutional indifference. We also find people investigating trafficking that don't really know what they're looking for. if you go into a country and you're talking to defense contractors and they're telling you, yeah, we have a lot of people who are ending up in raids, and then we've arranged with the local law enforcement to have them call us, and then we take our men and we rapidly repatriate them, there should be big warning signs. No ad hoc relationship between defense contractors and local law enforcement, number one. Number two, when you rapidly repatriate, you will have no prosecution. You will have no witnesses. And those people could be serving elsewhere. And who knows what they're doing. But also, maybe there's something more to this story. And in fact, in that particular case, we interviewed the company executives when we came back from our travels who said, yeah, actually, we have a pretty bad problem. We had somebody inside the base who was providing males to somebody on the outside of the base who had females who were trafficked. When the base found out about it, they rapidly repatriated that person, but our employee had also hired another employee as his own force protection, a guy with a gun. They held the guy with a gun for a week, and then they dismissed him too. And again, that story will be familiar to those of you who've read Martina's story, not because it's the same, it's not the same story from her report, because it's the same thing that happens over and over again. Okay, so we have one bit of good news. We actually have policies. In March 2000, when I first went to NATO headquarters and mentioned this, there was lots of snickering and rolled eyes and boys will be boys. After a lot of meetings and discussion, but also leadership inside NATO, we actually were able to organize the first meeting at NATO headquarters with all NATO ambassadors on this issue in March 2004. In spring 2004, we commented on the NATO policy. In June 2004, they adopted the NATO policy at the Istanbul summit. And since June 2004, we've been watching and listening to see what the response has been. The response has been several non-NATO members have held meetings. We're very grateful to the Swiss, the Finns, and the Swedes for hosting these meetings. We very much hope to see major NATO peace-contributing countries host these meetings. Both NATO and the Department of Defense, in some respects, their major response has been long-distance training modules. And we think that that is a start, but it is not nearly sufficient, that we are talking about very great organizational culture challenges. And in order to do that, we need to have more robust responses. This may be a little bit, for those of you who are familiar with UN Resolution 1325, we may be experiencing some of the same thing, where we have high-level people who are talking about this, we have policies, but we're not seeing actual implementation. What we really want, and we're not asking the moon, we're asking for leadership, resources, expertise, serious awareness campaigns, and we are asking for a shift in organizational culture. Senior leadership on the Department of Defense front, not yet. Maureen's going to talk about where we are with the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. In the first printing of the bill, there were several recommendations from the CSIS report that were in the bill. It has been somewhat gutted, I'm sorry to say, and those a lot of those recommendations are not in there, although there is more of a focus on peacekeeping than there has been in any other. But we suspect that what's there is not going to address the problem, and there are very specific reasons why those things were taken out. We can talk about that. The resources, again, at the moment, the Department of Defense, with a $450 billion budget, does not have a separate line item on this issue. And if the U.S. is going to lead on this issue, it might make sense for those outside to see the U.S. Having a line item. When you think about the fact that the Department of Defense budget is larger than all NATO countries' defense budgets combined, there's an added element of this. Expertise, again, not seeing it inside the Department of Defense. And while we have good relations with our colleagues in the back row, we don't have a lot of regular sustained contact with others inside the Department of Defense. Substantive training materials, not clear. I know Martina spent hours, literally hours, commenting. It's not clear to me how many of those comments were taken. Transparency, I'd have to say not yet. Investigation and prosecution, again, not yet. The point is that in the next several years, there are many of us who will be watching, will have very specific criteria by which to measure whether these policies are being implemented. We understand it takes a long time to shift organizational cultures, but we also understand that some posters that are posted on the wall outside are not going to do it, that long-distance training modules are likely not going to do it, and we look forward to working with these organizations to make the implementation real. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by thanking CSIS for inviting me to speak today on this very important issue. I've set for myself to answer three basic questions. The first question is what? The second question is how? And the third question, the most important question, I think, is why? So let me start with what. What is it that needs to be prosecuted? What is it that we're talking about? And what is it that is not being prosecuted? The Human Rights Watch report that Sarah mentioned that was published in 2002, which can be downloaded from the Human Rights Watch website, documented numerous cases of U.S. contractors, both military and civilian, who actually purchased women from brothels and from traffickers as chattel. They purchased the women, they purchased their passports. In some cases, they took those women home with them back to their residences that were in civilian communities. When asked, when interviewed, these men generally said that they had purchased the women in order to rescue them. No one bothered to interview the women to find out whether they had been rescued indeed or whether they had simply traded one owner for another owner. But again, don't take my word for this. Let's take it straight from the State Department, because one of the things that Human Rights Watch did was a series of FOIA requests asking for information specifically on cases that had been documented by the State Department. So let me read to you from several cables that came from this FOIA request. The first comes from Kosovo, and it's a FOIA request that was actually quite difficult. The State Department first refused to provide this particular document, and then only on appeal did provide it. It's a cable labeled confidential, which states, "A recent UNMIC, UN mission in Kosovo, internal affairs investigation has found that two American civilian police officers were involved in a number of activities that violated the UN Civilian Police Code of Conduct. The two officers have been fired, and the State Department is now considering what additional actions may be taken against them." None is the answer. Paragraph 3 states, "The UN investigation found that one of these officers was involved with a known criminal and brothel owner and accepted gifts from him in the form of girls," in quotations. "We take this report very seriously and note that this is not the first time that U.S. and other civilian police have been found to be engaged with prostitutes, nightclub owners, and/or other activities related to the sex trade." Again, related to human trafficking, because in the context of Kosovo, much of this was human trafficking. It wasn't just the sex trade. "International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, a department within the State Department, has improved its pre-deployment briefings on issues related to the trafficking of women and has instituted a no-tolerance policy," et cetera, et cetera. Sarah alluded to the finger-pointing that goes on and the "it's not my fault" attitude. I think paragraph 4 is indicative of exactly that attitude on the part of the U.S. government. Paragraph 4 states, in part, "The focus of this discussion," again, a discussion with the public and with the U.N., "the focus of this discussion should be on what the UN is doing to discourage, investigate, and respond on a systematic basis." The U.S. government didn't want to talk about what the U.S. government was doing and preferred to keep the focus on the United Nations. In an unclassified memorandum that was released also by a FOIA request, there's yet another case that's documented. Paragraph 2 states, "In a fairly clear-cut case, an American officer was fired after he admitted that he bought out the contract of a 19-year-old woman trafficked from Russia, with whom he cohabitated for 6 months. This officer also admitted bringing sensitive documents about forthcoming International Police Task Force raids to his residence, where this woman may have had access to them." So these are not occasional anecdotal cases documented by idealistic non-governmental organizations. These are actually concrete cases that are being written about in State Department State Department cables. So I think that answers the question of what. What we're talking about is engagement in trafficking-related activities, including the purchase of human beings as chattel by U.S. personnel engaged as contractors abroad, engaged both as U.S. Department of Defense contractors and also U.S. civilian contractors engaged with contracts to the State Department and other civilian agencies. That answers the question of what. Now I'd like to turn to the question of how. Technically, some of these contractors could be prosecuted. Technically, some of them still cannot. Contractors who are on contract to the Department of Defense or who have a nexus with the Department of Defense after an amendment last year can be prosecuted under U.S. law, under what's called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act of 2000. It's Public Law 106778. Section 3261 of that law permits the prosecution of a U.S. contractor engaged in a U.S. contract for the Department of Defense who engages in criminal activity that would be punishable by a year in prison were it committed in the United States. So it's a high bar. It has to be a criminal act that could be prosecuted in the United States and would be punishable by a year. But nonetheless, the jurisdiction exists. There is extraterritorial jurisdiction, but not for everyone. And this is a key point. Not for everyone. It does not cover people who are contractors to the Department of State. All of the United Nations U.S. police officers who are contracted and are serving abroad in U.N. missions are contractors to the Department of State. They are not covered by the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. What's more, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act is, I think, honored in the breach. There's only been one prosecution that we're aware of under the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. It was a prosecution of a woman who went to Turkey to visit her husband, who was in the Air Force. He was a sergeant at the air base in Turkey. While she was there, she stabbed her husband and killed him. Her defense was that he had threatened to kill her and that he had physically harmed her. The case was tried in Riverside, California. The first jury was hung, and she was finally convicted of voluntary manslaughter. So the only case that we have of a prosecution in the United States is not the prosecution of a trafficker or not the prosecution of someone who is on contract abroad and has violated U.S. law. It's a prosecution of a woman whose defense was the battered women's defense. I find that slightly ironic. It does not cover State Department personnel. And so even though we've had numerous State Department officials testify before Congress saying that they are working on it and that they hope to be able to prosecute U.S. personnel who are contracted to the State Department, we haven't seen any movement whatsoever. And in fact, to even get regulations to implement the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act took 4 years. The guidelines, the implementation regulations, did not go through until September of 2004. We had no regulations. There are people here from the Department of Justice today in the audience. There may be cases in the pipeline. I certainly hope so. But to be frank, I rather doubt it. So we've talked now about one method, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. There is an attempt, and Maureen will discuss this, to pass what we have dubbed CEJA, the Civilian Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which would provide jurisdiction to prosecute civilians who commit crimes while abroad, who are contracted with civilian agencies. CEJA is, we hope, on track, but again, Maureen will talk about that. There's one other method to prosecute U.S. personnel who are serving abroad, and this method is one that was hit upon, I think, rather in a bit of luck. As part of the Patriot Act, when there were accusations that Pissarro, a CIA contractor, had committed torture in a prison in Afghanistan, prosecutors began to thrash around, frankly, and look for ways that he could be prosecuted under U.S. law. As you know, in that particular case, he was working in the CIA, or he was working in the prison in Afghanistan, and the prisoner that he interrogated eventually died. Under U.S. law, Title 18, Section 79A, which you probably didn't want to know, of the U.S. Code, federal jurisdiction is now also extended to U.S. diplomatic, consular, military, or other U.S. government missions or entities in foreign states, including the buildings, parts of buildings, and land appurtenant or ancillary thereto, or used for purposes of those missions, entities, irrespective of ownership. So essentially what the U.S. government has done is create U.S. territory abroad. It has essentially ruled that this is now U.S. territory, and that was the basis upon which Pissarro was prosecuted in the United States and North Carolina. All of this legal jurisdictional gobbledygook aside, I think there's one bottom line, and the bottom line is why? My final question. Why have there not been any prosecutions? Why have we not seen any, despite what I think is credible evidence that U.S. contractors have engaged in trafficking-related activities and could have been prosecuted in the United States? Just as a footnote, I want to add that the people who committed these crimes generally went home on the next plane out. The investigations were shoddy. They were fired from their jobs, but there's very little follow-up to determine what happened to them afterwards. For all we know, they could be serving with a different contracting agency in Iraq or Afghanistan or another country. The bottom line is, if there are no investigations, there will be no prosecutions. What we found when I was doing the research for Human Rights Watch, and what we found in these FOIA request responses since, is that in many, many cases, U.S. government investigators would not know trafficking if they saw it. And let me just give you a few examples. The U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Division produced several reports. One of them was of a U.S. military contractor, Department of Defense contractor, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, who purchased a woman from a brothel in a package deal with an Uzi. And he paid a certain amount in Deutschmarks for the package deal of the woman and the Uzi. The woman, who spoke very little English, came home and lived with him when he was investigated by the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division after a whistleblower blew the whistle on him. He claimed that he had rescued her. She was not interviewed. She was let go. Months later, she turned up at an international police task force office and told a Ukrainian police officer, a woman there who spoke her own language, told the Ukrainian police officer that she had been purchased, that her last owner, and she called him an owner, was an American man, that he held her passport and would not let her leave the house, that she lived with him in the house like a prostitute, and then finally he gave her her passport back only when he was repatriated on weapons charges. So he was repatriated, not prosecuted in the United States, but repatriated because he had purchased and possessed a weapon, not because he had purchased a human being. In another case, we found a cable that documented a case of an American who was found to be driving drunk. He managed to, this was again a U.S. contractor, he managed to crash his truck into a bar, went headfirst into the bar. He fled the scene of the accident and left two injured Moldovan women in the car. Two Moldovan women, no one knew why they were there, who they were. Finally, locals took them to the hospital where they were eventually taken care of and I believe eventually repatriated. Because we are not asking the right questions in the field and because we are not interviewing the victims, I think that is the answer why there are no prosecutions. We must both interview but also protect the victims, and that means that the Department of Defense and the United Nations needs to be working far closer with local non-governmental organizations who actually have the capacity to keep women in shelters and to protect them. So I look forward to seeing cases coming down the pipeline. I hope that we will see prosecutions in the United States, but until we have adequate investigation and adequate protection, I think we'll see neither. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I'm going to stay in my seat so I can shuffle papers a little bit. I'm Maureen Walsh, and I serve as General Counsel to the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is also known as the U.S. Helsinki Commission. And just in brief, the Commission is an independent agency of the U.S. government. We were created by a statute back in 1976. We have 21 commissioners. 18 of them are members of Congress, and 3 of them are appointed by the President to represent the Department of State, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Defense. But our leadership is in the Congress. Our chairman is Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, and our co-chairman is Congressman Chris Smith from New Jersey. And I just have to say, please don't construe anything that I might say as representing the position of any of the, either those members or any of the other members of our commission. I don't speak for any particular commissioner. I've worked on the trafficking issue primarily working with Congressman Smith since about 1999 and have been involved in the legislative process. So I'm just going to speak to you a little bit about what led us to address these issues and where we are in the legislative process today in terms of trying to respond. In addition, I'm going to just say a few words. In addition to the work that I do with directly with the Congress, our mandate as from the, at the Helsinki Commission is also to encourage the governments that participate in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to live up to the human rights commitments that they've freely made. And there are 55 countries that participate in the OSCE. The United States is one, Canada is another, and then all the rest are the countries of Europe and Eurasia, the former Soviet states, et cetera. So I'll speak a little bit about what we're trying to do in the OSCE to address the question of peacekeepers and human trafficking. Just to explain what led us, what led the Helsinki Commission to respond to these issues, what led members of Congress to introduce legislation, first was the contractor scandals. And you know, the late 1990s, we had serious problems, as Martina has just described, in southeastern Europe involving U.S. government contractors, particularly DynCorp. In April 2002, the International Relations Committee held a hearing at which there was simply damning testimony given by human rights investigators from the UN and others, including Martina, about these, you know, the results of her study and you know, documenting exactly what was going on in Bosnia. Today, unfortunately, we're still seeing contractor cases which are of great concern. The Chicago Tribune article, which came out last month, indicates problems with a subcontractor of KBR, which is allegedly trafficking people from Nepal into Iraq for purposes of essentially forced labor on U.S. military bases. What's a similar story came out last year involving Indian workers. When I made inquiries to the State Department about it, they said they had tried to track it down and were never able to document what was really happening or that, in fact, there was a trafficking violation going on here, and so it was not pursued. I think with the current allegations in the Chicago Tribune, we need to go back and revisit that question with the State Department and certainly with the Department of Defense. But what's most troubling in that article is the attempt to deflect responsibility. The Kellogg Brown and Root spokesperson said, this is a question for our subcontractors, it's not our responsibility. And then the U.S. Army spokesperson said, this is a question for our contractor, it's not our responsibility. That's the most troubling aspect of that article for me. And I'll speak a little bit about what we've tried to do to respond to that as well. But just one of the other issues that has led us to this, in spring of 2002, a investigative journalist from Fox News in Cleveland brought a videotape to Congressman Smith's office and other offices on Capitol Hill where he had gone to South Korea, particularly Camp Casey, and or the Tongdachan right outside of Camp Casey, and with his hidden camera had spoken to some U.S. military service members in uniform on courtesy patrol who were talking about, you know, where you could get the best sex and the cheapest prices and how the women in these places were Ukrainians or Russians or Filipinos, and they were auctioned off at the airport and their passports were taken. And, you know, again, a classic red flags for trafficking situation. And it was just dismissed. It was like, this is how it happens, but you know, let me hook you up with the best mamasan so you can get the best deal. This infuriated members of Congress, and it led to a request for an inspector general investigation in South Korea and worldwide. And that, in fact, has resulted in two reports from the inspector general's office. In those particular cases, what we were seeing was a demand side problem. There was not actually any evidence that the uniformed service members themselves were involved in buying women or trafficking them into bars or brothels. It was a demand side question. The women who are working or who are in Tongdachan in prostitution against their will are there because of the American military clientele. That's a demand side problem, which has a different response than traditional trafficking would require. And then just very quickly, other issues that we saw, we did see, again, trafficking, actual trafficking by peacekeepers in southeastern Europe, not United States military, but other militaries which were engaged in trafficking. Some of that's documented in Sarah's report. And then in the past year or so, we've also looked increasingly at the sexual exploitation and abuse questions in connection with the UN. Congressman Smith and the International Relations Committee have held a number of hearings on the situation in the Congo. And so trafficking and sexual exploitation and abuse, or trafficking on one hand and sexual exploitation on the other, are not legally necessarily the same things. But in terms of the responses that we've been trying to create, in many respects, these things have come together because we don't want to be only focusing on the trafficking and as if we don't realize that there are these other sexual exploitation problems happening. So some of our responses have merged the two. Basically, our effort in the current legislation, which was introduced in February on the House side, has passed the International Relations Committee and is going to the Judiciary Committee probably on December 7th for consideration. Our attempt basically is to ratchet up the political pressure, which will generate the political will to address the problem. There are some legal fixes that are needed, but at the end of the day, much of this has to do with political will. And if governments do not decide that they actually want to take responsibility for their peacekeeping personnel, whether it's a person in uniform or a person on contract, they're not going to take that responsibility until they decide that it matters and that there's a cost for not taking responsibility. So some of the things that the bill would require, that the trafficking in persons report issued yearly by the State Department would include reporting on what the international organizations are doing to prevent trafficking and sexual exploitation and abuse by personnel of the organizations as well as people serving on peacekeeping missions. It's a reporting mechanism. It would also require, and I think this is significant, the minimum standards that the State Department uses every year to essentially analyze how well governments are doing in fighting trafficking would have a new element. And that would be, there actually are several elements, but one relevant to this. One of the criteria that would be used would be whether or not, in fact, the government is taking efforts to address the peacekeeping issue, whether they have in place in their laws a legal mechanism to hold peacekeepers accountable when they're on mission. And if a government is not taking steps to make sure that they can hold people legally accountable, then that would be a reason for a lower ranking in the trafficking in persons report. So this is, again, a way of trying to put political pressure for political will. We would also require that the Secretary of State report to Congress before endorsing a peacekeeping mission at an international organization, basically reporting to Congress on what steps have been put in place or what steps are envisioned for the new or reauthorized peacekeeping mission to ensure that trafficking situations don't arise, to ensure that sexual exploitation and abuse doesn't arise, and to hold people accountable if, in fact, despite these efforts, there is a problem. The Commerce, Justice, State Appropriations Bill, which just passed the Senate yesterday, the conference report, it's going to go to the President's desk probably in a matter of days, actually contains language very similar to this. We think they lifted it out of our bill. We're very flattered. Which says that no peacekeeping funds appropriated under the Act can be used until the Appropriations Committee receives a report essentially on what is being put in place in these new and reauthorized peacekeeping missions to prevent trafficking and sexual exploitation and abuse. So that's actually, you know, about to be placed into law. That's significant. One of the other things that is in the bill, which I'm sorry, I don't think I said, it's H.R. 972. It's the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2005, and it reauthorizes the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000. One of the significant elements in it, which we're very hopeful will go forward, it seems to have the support of the Judiciary Committee at this point. It seems to have the support of the Department of Justice, is what Martina referred to as CEJA. The bill doesn't call it CEJA, but we call it CEJA. And it would create extraterritorial jurisdiction over not only contractors with any agency, but also federal government employees and their dependents, people who accompany them overseas on official business. If any of those people engage in a trafficking offense while they're overseas, any offense relating to peonage, slavery, forced labor, trafficking, the various offenses that are in Chapter 77 and 117 of Title 18, they could be prosecuted in U.S. courts as if the crime had committed here. And this provision is in direct response to the International Police Task Force officers in Bosnia who were under Department of State contract and were untouchable. That's what that provision is responding to, and so we're very hopeful. And a couple of, I don't want to go on too long here, but a couple of things that I'll just say about the DOD provisions. We did have a number of provisions in the bill when we introduced it. One was to create a director of anti-trafficking position, anti-trafficking initiatives at the Department of Defense. Another was to was a proposal to put trafficking offenses directly into the Uniform Code of Military Justice. For reasons that I could go into perhaps in questions, we've agreed to take those provisions out, but in exchange, there's going to be a directive to the Joint Service Commission to analyze the legal issue of trafficking and determine if, in fact, the UCMJ is currently sufficient to prosecute trafficking offenses if committed by a service member, because the UCMJ generally applies only to uniformed military, not contractors. We also have a new directive to combatant commanders requiring that they actually identify a person on their staff at a high level who would have responsibility for anti-trafficking initiatives. The general in South Korea, General LaPorte, has done this because of the pressure that was brought to bear by Congress and the Department of Defense, and has really taken a tremendous leadership role in trying to find some solutions, but that's not the case in other military deployments around the world. We'd like to see something, we think something is required beyond just South Korea, and so this directive will hopefully do that. We've also agreed with the Armed Services Committee to mandate training for criminal investigative, criminal investigative division personnel on how to investigate and actually identify trafficking cases, and also for the JAGs, the military lawyers, how to understand trafficking and how to prosecute them under existing law. And then we're also hoping for some additional congressional hearings, oversight hearings on this. So that's where the bill is. It has about 90 co-sponsors right now in the House. And this, I think its passage is looking very positive. So we're very hopeful. Might not make it by the end of this session, but it will certainly be at the top of the agenda at the beginning of next session if we don't get it done this before Congress adjourns. Just very briefly, what we're doing in the context of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is a multilateral organization based in Vienna, Austria. It's made up of governments. Last year, the United States proposed a decision on ensuring that international peacekeeping forces contribute to combating trafficking in persons. We want states to accept responsibility for their personnel when they're on these missions. We want them to train people before they ever go, and we want them to prosecute them, to hold them legally accountable if they engage in misconduct while they're on a peacekeeping mission. Last year, the decision was agreed to by 54 countries and blocked by Russia. Russia's explanation was that we hadn't given them enough time to consider it. So we told them right away, okay, well, we'll reintroduce it next year. You've got 13 months to think about it. So we've reintroduced it. This year we've actually expanded it beyond just trafficking. As I said, we've also added in the concepts of sexual exploitation and abuse because it seemed, given what has transpired with the UN in the past year, it would have been just very odd not to address the larger issues in this particular decision. Essentially, what we're looking for is a high standard of conduct that is uniformly applicable to people serving on these missions. We don't want one standard for the person in uniform, one standard for the person on a contract. You know, there are just too many different categories of people. They all need to be held to a common high standard of contract, similar to what the UN Secretary General has promulgated in his bulletin on sexual exploitation and abuse, and then the trafficking policy. Right now, it is this proposal is receiving opposition so far from one country, and I'm not going to name it because the negotiations are still ongoing. But essentially, the concern is that even though the decision is clearly limited to behavior while in peacekeeping missions or other similar deployments, the concern is that by referencing the UN Secretary's General Bulletin, we're setting a precedent which may ultimately lead to service members not being allowed to buy the services of prostitutes, period. They're concerned that that eventually this will take us down that road where no matter whether the service member is in a place where it's legal or where it's not legal, they won't be able to buy sex from prostitutes. So I will leave that with you to think about. We're concerned about rape of 12-year-old girls, and we think that is frankly the most important consideration here. So I've put copies of the decision in the back if anybody wants them. It has not been agreed to by the states. It's still a draft decision. And so just keep that in mind, but that the current United States proposal is back there. I think with that, I will end. Thank you.
Maureen, let me ask you two really quick questions before we open this up. Is there a time frame on when the directive to the combatant commanders would be? When would they have to implement? And when is the time up for when the Russian Federation, when you're going to reintroduce this issue for the OSCE? Is that December?
The proposal is currently being negotiated in Vienna. The Ministerial Council of the OSCE will be meeting at the beginning of December.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consensus needs to be reached by the meeting in Ljubljana.
Okay. And for the U.S. combatant commanders?
I don't have an answer for that exactly. I think it's an important question. In negotiating the bill with the Armed Services Committee and thereby with the Department of Defense, we agreed to take out certain provisions of the bill and to do further steps. We're going to do a letter which will outline these things to the mm-hmm. combatant commanders. But then also, I believe we agreed in the Defense Authorization Act for next year, we mm-hmm. would specifically include this language as well. And so coming up with an actual deadline for action would be important.
Well, it's something I think that we at CSIS would hope to be involved in, and we could be a source of information for them. Okay, to you. Questions, please. And when you have a question, please state who you are.
Maureen, under the UCMJ, haven't they already prosecuted some of the trafficking cases, but not as trafficking, but as rape cases? In the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, not to my knowledge, nobody has mentioned that to me. And in fact, that would be a trafficking case by a uniformed service member. So I'm actually not aware of those cases. I'd be interested to hear if they're there. There have been people who have been held accountable for solicitation of prostitution under the general article which exists in the UCMJ. But to my knowledge, those were buying prostitution, buying sex from a prostitute, as opposed to buying a person as chattel, which is a different concept. So I'm not aware of the...
Well, when you're talking about that the UCMJ is going to take a look at what they have to see if it's sufficient enough, mm-hmm. I mean, are they saying that rape is not sufficient enough, so they can't get them on trafficking as it stands now?
Well, I mean, I think that if there was a trafficking case, it could be possibly very well be prosecuted as a rape case. But just as we went and amended federal law to include trafficking as a separate offense, we believe that there is good reason to call trafficking offenses and not try and prosecute them under lesser included crimes. Perhaps for me, one of the most significant reasons is that by having it as an identifiable defense in the or an identifiable offense in the code, people identify it as such. They don't just say this is a woman who's living with this person and he raped her. He actually bought her. He trafficked in human beings, and that is a concept in and of itself. So,
I'll get you the information because there are two cases that actually look like trafficking cases within the military, and that they were prosecuted, but they were prosecuted for rape.
Lisa Burgess with Stars and Stripes. Can I ask you to, again, I'm a little confused about this directive to the combatant commanders. This is something that has not been issued, but General LaPorte has already gone ahead and done. And when did this get negotiated and agreed to, and who would the directive come from to the commanders?
Okay. The directive has not been issued that I'm discussing. It was part of the negotiation on the Trafficking Reauthorization Act. There have been some directives issued by the Department of Defense on the need for combatant commanders to combat trafficking and cooperate with host governments and these types of things. Both the Secretary of Defense and the Deputy Secretary, former Deputy Secretary, issued those types of directives. What we are looking what will be coming from Congress through the Defense Authorization Act will be a directive that combatant commanders should have a particular focal point with responsibility for enforcing, for following up on the implementation of those SecDef and Deputy SecDef directives. General LaPorte, when he, I traveled to South Korea 6 months after the Fox News journalists came to Congressman Smith's office, and I met with General LaPorte as well as a whole host of other people. At the time, they really didn't understand what trafficking was. I mean, they literally, you know, told us they thought it meant like boat people. Not General LaPorte, but one of his assistants told me that. There has been a tremendous learning curve there, and he, General LaPorte himself, has become personally seized with the issue and has done a lot in just using his leadership position to get the word out that trafficking and creating a demand for trafficking into prostitution is unacceptable. It's not consistent with the military's values. And so he's done those things, you know, in response to the pressure that and the unflattering publicity that he received. But so the directive is not something that we're saying he needs more direction. He obviously has it at this point. It's other combatant commanders around the world who we want to see be similarly engaged. I just have to reiterate, in case you weren't here at the beginning, I'm not speaking on the record for quotes in the press at this point. So if you want to talk about that, we can do that afterwards.
Add that when we hosted the meeting with the U.S. mission at NATO and the Norwegian mission at NATO in March 2004, the invitation was to all NATO ambassadors and military representatives. We had hoped to have a speaker, the commander from AFSOUTH, come, and he was online to come and pulled out at the last minute, ostensibly for weather, although he was in London, and he was supposed to have a leave-behind person come as well. And, of course, there is a underground tunnel that one can get to Brussels from London. The point is that when we held that meeting, we had almost no senior military representatives around the table or sitting behind the ambassadors, as is the tradition at NATO. We've had a hard time getting there are letters, there's rhetorical support sometimes, but there needs to be more. And so the issue is, and this is not terribly complicated. Once it comes, and I think on the U.S. side, if the SACUR comes out, for example, very clearly and repeatedly, then uniformed service members are likely to fall in behind. But there's been a little bit of, the messages are very mixed at this point. And again, we have several times reached out to senior commanders and said, we would like to explain to you why this is of interest to you, why this affects your mission. Particularly in that case for the Balkans, but certainly around the world. Other questions?
Sir, what is it that they say to you?
Well, again, I mean, in the case of the March 2004, it was they said they would show up and then they didn't show up. And not having the AFSOUTH person, we think, sent a lot of signals. It is repeatedly sort of saying to AFSOUTH, let's talk about this in the Balkan context, and having mid-level people say, this is really important, but we're having trouble getting the senior folks to respond. It is constantly having meetings in non-NATO countries where the military representatives that are speaking are, and they're speaking very eloquently, but they're Swedish, they're Finnish, the Norwegians, I think, I can't remember if they spoke, they are a member of NATO, obviously. But it's We are still waiting to hear from the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans, and frankly, from the US. Yes. That's an excellent question, and at CSIS, I think we'd like to take that seriously, and we'd like to research it. I will give you a working response. There is a lot of language behind the U.S. Again, we have not seen any senior leadership or resources. I think among some Scandinavian countries, the training was already happening. Because of our footprint is so large, it's hard. We do expect more from the U.S. military, and we expect more from U.S. defense contractors. So on some level, the response from the Americans has been utterly inadequate. When you compare it to, we've heard nothing from the British, the French, the Italians, and we know that there have been ongoing cases, for example, involving French in Kosovo. The Russian military, I'd have to say, has been particularly bad. We know that they have a long history of active engagement in trafficking. And, their response inside the OSCE, I think, is indicative. I've focused on European, Eurasian. Maybe some others would like to respond. Other parts of the world?
I would rank the United States high in the area of rhetoric and low in the area of implementation. And the reason I say that is because I think, first of all, we have to be careful when we're using the word peacekeeping, because peacekeeping covers a number of sins. It's a very sloppy word. Looking at U.S. military alone and the military element of peacekeeping, I think that because the U.S. force protection rules in the Balkans were so strict, it was very difficult for U.S. military personnel to leave the bases. And for that reason, I think we saw very little involvement in trafficking by U.S. service members. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't any. Human Rights Watch actually found out about trafficking in Bosnia and Herzegovina by interviewing members of the U.S. military special forces who, in sitting down for a beer with several investigators, when asked if they knew of any brothels in Bosnia and Herzegovina, rattled off the names of 10, names like Madonna, Dallas, had been to all of them. And these were Joint Commission observers who claimed that they had gone to all of them in order to collect intelligence, because this was where people indicted for war crimes would hang out. So I think it is not fair to say that there was no U.S. involvement. Now, these U.S. service members, of course, denied that they had ever gone there for sex. They confirmed that they were subject to a complete non-fraternization order, although sotto voce, some people would say, well, we have a non-fraternization order, but we just can't have sex with Bosnians, which is why it's so great that there are Russians here. So, I mean, there was a little bit of going around the rules. That said, the U.S. service members traveled along with a contractor, and that's part two of peacekeeping. And this Department of Defense contractor bragged to the Human Rights Watch investigators, I was among them, that the sex was great, the women were beautiful, they were incredibly young, and it was cheap. And so it was clear that this U.S. contractor, who wasn't subject to the same rules that his Joint Commission observers, colleagues were, it was clear that he was going to the brothels. And he knew or should have known that these were trafficked women. And the reason I say that is because the Joint Commission observers, who, unlike regular U.S. military forces, lived in communities and rented a house in the community, these particular ones were in Republika Srpska, they had invited the young women back to their houses for a party. And the young women said to these U.S. military personnel, we can't go, we don't have our passports, we can't leave, and if we left the brothel, we'd be beaten. again, as Maureen said, red flags should have immediately gone off, been visible to these U.S. personnel, but they didn't know what they were looking at all. These were, you know, young men from Iowa who'd never heard of trafficking in their lives. So they knew or should have known that these women were trafficked, but they were totally ignorant. The contractor had sex with them anyway, and that seemed fine to him. In terms of the United States performance on the civilian side, particularly looking at the United Nations police forces, I think here the performance is particularly abysmal, because the United States goes around the country, and particularly to NATO countries, preaching to these countries that they absolutely have to hold their personnel accountable. And there's a dab of hypocrisy there, because the United States government has not passed any legislation providing for a jurisdiction to prosecute U.S. civilian contractors serving abroad, number one. And number two, we're actually worse off than many of the European countries who are sending police officers who are actually members of an individual police department. So, for example, when allegations come up against French police officers, the French police officers are actually members of a national French police force. And when they go home, they don't go home into obscurity with no one knowing. They go home with a record, and they go back to their police force where there's a command and control hierarchy, and they are punished. When a U.S. police officer goes abroad and serves with a UN mission, he comes from one of the 18,000 separate police departments in the United States. If he conducts trafficking-related activities while he's abroad, he leaves. Sure, maybe he has a dark mark on his record from DynCorp, but that never is transferred back to his home office. It's never transferred back to his commanding officers in the U.S. police department that he comes from. There's absolutely no accountability. And in fact, if you look at it, many of the U.S. police officers who are serving abroad with UN missions are actually retired. So not only are they not prosecuted, they are also not held accountable professionally when they get home. It's simple total impunity for U.S. police officers at this point.
And I'll just give you some of the experiences I've had with the troop contributing countries to UN peacekeeping missions. Indeed, we've heard that the Russians are pushing back at DPKO as well on implementing some of the reforms within the UN. We've also heard that Egypt is also one of the groups that's pushing back. The US is, you know, very absorbed in UN reform right now, but it does seem to be being transmitted that this is a problem with developing country militaries, the ones who go into UN peacekeeping missions. That's why it's heartening to hear that it's, you know, not just the problem there. Pakistanis and the Bangladeshis deny that this is a problem in their militaries. I've met with a Bangladeshi woman who is, and this is in my report, I try to link up the fact that we need to get involved women's organizations in the countries of these troop contributing countries, because they know differently. And the Bangladeshis, you know, say, well, there's very little that's going on. Show me the records that show that Bangladeshis have been involved in this. Well, as we know, the UN has had very bad record keeping up until recently on this. Nigeria and Ghana Nigeria in particular were notorious in Liberia when they came in under ICOMOG for, you know, there's stories of them stealing everything that wasn't nailed down, you know, concrete bricks in a boat that sank because it was too heavy. They have been reformed. In general, they have a pretty high marks now in UN peacekeeping missions because of U.S. Department of Defense training of them. So that's ironic that we're having that problem in our own military. Ireland has contacted us. They've had problems in Eritrea and Ethiopia, Irish peacekeepers who were repatriated. They say they want to be the leader. They are a Western country that actually contributes troops to UN peacekeeping missions, and they want to reform and make sure that they can hold themselves up as the group that you can look to. In Haiti, it's mostly Latin American groups that are doing the peacekeeping there. It's Chile, Peru, and Brazil. In general, the Brazilian commander said, oh, you know, it's a big problem, but what are you going to do? I mean, you know, you got men, they need to have sex. What are we going to do? The Peruvians we interviewed said, they're banging on our doors every night. Who are we to deny them? You know. So there's a great researcher, Paul Highgate, who works in South Africa, the Institute for Security Studies. He's been looking at this for a while, and he has reviewed in Sierra Leone and Congo, talking a lot with male peacekeepers. The fact that I'm a female makes it kind of difficult sometimes for me to really get the true opinions of the male peacekeepers themselves. But there's also a nice report that he wrote that I'd like to recommend called See the World, Meet Interesting People, Have Sex with Them. Tourism, Sex, and Recruitment in the U.S. Military. So I recommend that. So thank you.
Can I just say a couple things here, and I think we're probably about to wrap up. In terms of how the United States is doing on this, I guess I'm a pragmatist. I think that this is a slow-moving ship, frankly. And 5 years ago, the Department of Defense wasn't at the table. They were not involved with the interagency process to address trafficking in the United States at all. And they now are. And so, I see that as progress. They do have training. I think it can be made better. We do have some commanders who are engaged. I think we should have them all engaged. I'm not able to say, we are better than most countries or worse than most countries. I think we've seen a lot of progress. We've got the statements from the most senior person at the Department of Defense saying this is an issue. U.S. military should not be involved in trafficking. Combatant commanders should address it. And truly, it's a question of making sure that that's implemented on a very practical basis. So that's what we're going to continue to work for. But I just want to end my comments with one thing with you, just in terms of the perception that we're trying to change, and the general mindset among just the military, peacekeepers, and all those definitions. It's just a huge challenge. I have a poster I'm going to show you. It was posted in the UN headquarters in Cyprus. Some of my colleagues, some people I work with, were there for a trafficking conference a few months ago, and they were having a fall festival. And this poster says, Big Brother Auction. Ever wanted your own slave? Nominate your slave for only one Cyprus pound. The top 10, if you're the highest bidder, you have your own slave for 6 hours. Please be gentle. And the picture is, I guess I would have to say, I'll leave it up here, a woman in a dominatrix outfit who has at her feet another woman dressed in very revealing lingerie, who's licking her boots. And needless to say, the people who were at the trafficking meeting were appalled. And the folks at the headquarters were like, well, it's a joke. It's just a joke. And he said, well, but do you understand the perception? And the perception is that you all don't get that there's a problem here. And this type of poster, this type of activity, simply fosters the view of those of us who are working on this that there's a lot of work to do in changing mindsets and hearts.
We are going to have to wrap up. I want to say that the vision is to have a tipping point that you get increasing numbers of people, leaders in countries, leaders in organizations, that understand and share the information that we've been discussing today, and who are advancing this. And I think that this is an issue. We have seen progress. I've seen it personally from. If in a four-year period of rolling eyes and winking and nodding and snickering to a policy at NATO, we just have to keep on it. And there is a role for every single person in this room to play in making sure implementation is serious and not just a piece of paper, and changing organizational cultures. So I thank you, and I look forward to the next time. Thanks a lot.